This is Pamela Paul with Inside the New York Times Book Review, and we are talking about this week's issue, May 19th, where we have The Golem and the Ginny by Helene Wecker.
They both arrive separately in 1899 New York through different mysterious circumstances and have to fit in amongst the humans of the city.
We'll also have David Carr, the New York Times media and business columnist, in to talk about David Sedaris' most recent book, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls.
The sense of opportunities missed as somebody who's in a middle age and looking often in the rear view, I sometimes see those same shapes in my past as well.
We'll have Julie Bosman with Notes from the Field, and as always, Greg Coles with our bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
I am here with Helene Wecker. She is calling in from Pleasanton, California. Helene is the author of The Golem and the Ginny, which is our cover review in this week's issue of the Book Review. Hi, Helene. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So your new novel, The Golem and the Ginny, this is your first book, was reviewed by Susan Kokel on our cover this week. How long were you working on this book?
It took 7 years from beginning to end.
And for those of us who are not familiar with the book, tell us a little bit about what it's about.
It takes place in 1899 in New York City. And it's about, like the cover says, a golem and a genie. A golem being a creature from Jewish folklore made usually out of clay to be a servant, and a genie, a creature of fire from Middle Eastern and Muslim folklore. The golem is female. The genie is male. They meet they both arrive separately in 1899 New York through different mysterious circumstances and have to fit in amongst the humans of the city.
And it's a love story.
It is. It is a love story in sort of after fashion, yes.
Okay. Now, it's interesting because there's so many books and movies that take place in what I guess we have to now call the turn of the last century. What was the draw of this time period? Why set it there and then?
One reason was because I was sort of one of my main reasons for writing the book was to explore issues of immigration, American immigration, culture clashes, and sort of the push and pull of being a stranger in a new world and feeling like you don't fit in anywhere anymore. And 1899 really was, that time period was sort of the height of immigration, especially to New York City, where you had these little pockets of different nationalities just shoved up against each other, sort of in this patchwork of New York that I know is still, you know, New York being a city of so many cultures, it still exists like that, but it was so much more heightened and everything was just so new and just the influx was so amazing at that time that it seemed like sort of the perfect time and place to really explore these issues.
Now, you're calling in from California, but are you a native New Yorker or have you lived here?
I was in New York for 2 years while I was getting my master's at Columbia in creative writing, and I did the first year of working on the book there.
And you did a lot of research on the time period and the city and what it was like back then.
Yeah, I did a ton of research. The first couple of years, I'd say, were half and half research and writing.
And the golem and the genie, did you research these myths and the origins of them? And what was the draw to you of these two very different characters?
Well, so that sort of goes back to how I started writing the book, which was that I was looking for a way to talk about my family history and my husband's family history. I'm Jewish and he's Arab American. And I had been working on these sort of linked short stories that were very realist stories, you know, had no elements of, you know, fantasy or folklore in them at all, that were stories taken directly from our families, but they weren't going very well. And I think part of it was because they were sort of received stories that I knew, in a sense, almost too well, and they sort of resisted fictionalization. And then a friend of mine suggested that I try adding a different element. She knew that I grew up on science fiction and fantasy, and that I loved sort of genre bending literature. And she suggested I try something like that. And so I was like, okay, well, instead of my Jewish girl and Arab American boy, what if I have a golem and a genie? And then I had to go and start to research these myths and you know, different variations of the legends and the folklore. And as I did, they really took on their own personalities and became much more than just stand-ins for, you know, myself and my husband or some generic Arab American boy and Jewish girl. So they really did become characters in their own right, which was wonderful.
And you also, I mean, you changed the myths a little bit. Tell us about, let's take the golem. What is the myth of the golem, and then how is your character different from that tradition?
Well, so the myth of a golem, the quintessential golem story is of Rabbi Lo, who was the head rabbi in Prague, in medieval Prague, and he created a golem to protect the Jews of Prague from the pogroms. And that golem it sort of typified the usual golem in literature and story, which is sort of a big hulking creature, almost always male, usually mute, sort of dumb, that doesn't do anything except its master's commands. And so for my story, what I wanted you know, something that was going to be more of a sympathetic and interesting main character than that. And so I decided that I was going to have a female golem who could pass for human instead of being sort of this, you know, giant person-shaped lump of clay, and who had enough of a personality and enough of her own volition to really, you know, walk and talk and understand the people around her, even though, you know, she has insight, but she doesn't really grasp humans straight off, and so that gulf between her and the people she's around sort of creates this huge perplexing problem for her.
And so, what does she retain from that original myth? Is she a protector, or is she a shapeshifter of some kind, or a moldable?
She's definitely dangerous. She has a dark side to her. Her creator says at the very beginning of the book, a creature can only be altered so far from its nature. So, and in her case, that means that she has the ability to seem like a human, but at her heart, she's a monster, and she will protect the ones that she loves or that she has decided she must protect. And at times that starts to get the better of her.
Tell us about the myth of the genie and where that what attracted you to that particular figure.
So the myth of the genie, you know, we know mostly from, you know, here in Western culture from, you know, 1001 Nights and I Dream of Genie and then horrible jokes about finding lamps on beaches and rubbing them and getting three wishes. Aladdin, yes, with Robin Williams in Big Blue Robin Williams. When I started with the idea, I was like, okay, so we have, I had to like take it back to the very basics. It was like a creature of fire. What does that sort of imply? And so I came up with someone who was mercurial, passionate, changeable, and a very free spirit. And one thing that happened when I was reading the myths, I had a sort of a period of struggling to, you know, sort of make it really my own because I wanted to be very careful about being, not appropriating another, you know, cultural element. But at the same time, there were so many different versions of what the djinn are and what a genie is like and what a genie does, that I decided that I really had to just sort of take him and make him my own in the same way that, you know, with vampires, it's like, okay, garlic or no garlic, crosses or no crosses. And, you know, at some point I had to just sort of step up and say, okay, this is what a genie is like in my version.
So you don't have, do you have to rub a bottle or?
No, well, there is a bottle. There's no rubbing. It's sort of more mechanical than that. But there are no wishes. I was pretty adamant that there are going to be no wishes in this book.
Why no wishes?
Because then it becomes about the person who's wishing, and it isn't about the character of the genie. I don't know, it just seems a little less interesting. And then it becomes also sort of about logic puzzles, and I am terrible with logic puzzles. They do reference the jinn's ability to give wishes, but in this version it is something that was lost long ago.
So I don't want to give away too much of the plot here, but you come up with these incredibly interesting, mysterious, magical creatures. What is their draw to each other?
They're very similar in some ways and completely opposite in others. They are both on the edges of their own societies. They both have to pass as human, and they are pretty much the only ones in New York who understand what it is that each other's going through, and they're the only ones who recognize each other's true natures. So that is sort of the ultimate draw for each of them, that in that sense they're kindred spirits and they're the only person the other one can talk to, really. But on the other hand, their personalities in many ways are complete polar opposites. The golem, you know, is built to serve, and she has that nature of wanting to serve, and is very sort of drawn to duty and helping others. And the genie is he's a sort of the quintessential free spirit, and he has to be constantly reminded and is very sort of angry about the fact that now he has to live among others, and when really all he wants to do is roam around and sort of indulge his own pleasures. So the two of them spark off each other quite a bit. It was once I'd established their characters, it became natural that every time they got together and talked, they just started arguing immediately. And those became some of the most difficult but also the most fun parts of the book to write, was the two of them just sparking off each other.
Well, hopefully that part isn't taken from the real-life love story. I'm with Helene Wecker, who is with us, actually joining us by phone from Pleasanton, California, and we have been talking about her debut novel, The Golem and the Ginny, which is our cover review in this week's issue of The Book Review. Helene, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others, written and read by Daniel Pink. That's To Sell is Human, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
I'm Pamela Paul, and I'm here with Julie Bosman, our publishing reporter, to talk about Notes in the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pam.
So what is going on in the world of publishing these days?
So this week we had a survey released, which is an annual snapshot of the publishing industry, and it really gives us a sense of what's up, what's down, what formats consumers are turning to, and what's popular.
And this is called BookStats?
This is called BookStats, and it's the work of two different trade groups, the Association of American Publishers and the Book Industry Study Group. And reliable numbers in the publishing industry, as you know, are kind of tough to come by. So this is an interesting look at what the last year held.
And so do we have any good news?
Well, it's interesting to see in this survey, like, the constant evolution of the way that people are reading. And one thing that was very clear from this survey is that paperback sales, hardcover sales were flat. There was almost no movement in the rate growth in paperback and hardcover. But what we did see is that ebook sales were up, and audiobook sales, the digital downloads of audio were up. So you can see the way that people is reading is really changing year over year. In 2011, ebooks made up about 15% of publishers' revenues. And in 2012, the most recent year that we have data, it made up about 20%. So you can see that there's still a lot of growth there.
Is it that there are more units of ebooks being sold, or have the prices changed at all? How has that affected things?
There are definitely more units being sold. You can see that people are reading more books than ever before. There are more books available to be read. So there's a lot more choices and more formats than ever before.
And so let's look into what they're reading on ebooks. Is this happening in both fiction and nonfiction? Is this all 50 Shades of Grey?
We can't have a conversation about book sales in 2012 without talking about 50 Shades of Grey, which really kind of took over the conversation. And we saw that reflected in these numbers. Ebook sales in fiction rose 42% in 2012. Over 2011 to $1.8 billion. And while 50 Shades of Grey was not completely responsible for that, it was really a driver of fiction sales. And what's interesting about the fiction numbers is that you can see that people are really looking to fiction. It's a discretionary purchase. It's something that is fun, enjoyable, and people are kind of feeling more free to just click and download a novel whenever they want.
And are they able to get any user data on this? Do we know who's purchasing what kinds of books, or is that not in there?
It's not in this particular survey, but we did see in nonfiction there was a much smaller increase. It was only 22% increase from 2011 to 2012.
22% increase in revenue or in the units?
In revenue.
In revenue. Now let's talk about children's and YA, because young adult, that was a bright spot in these figures, right?
It was. There was a lot of growth in children's and YA, about 117% increase in revenues in ebook sales from 2011 to 2012, and that went up to about $469 million. Now, of course, a lot of people who are reading YA novels are not teenagers. They're people like us who are downloading The Hunger Games and other YA books. So I think that's driving a lot of that growth.
And what happened on the print side with children's and young adults? Did that increase or was that flat too?
It was pretty flat. Hardcovers accounted for just over $5 billion in 2012, and it was up from about $4.9 billion in 2011. And we also saw a drop in mass market paperbacks, which, you know, those squat little books that you see in
the airports. Yes.
Yeah. So that format has really been replaced, or is about to be completely replaced, by ebooks, which is sort of the new disposable throwaway kind of format.
Right. And where are people buying these books?
So one thing that we saw in this survey, in a big change from 2011 to 2012, is that brick and mortar retail stores were down. And this survey didn't capture data from the retailer side. It asked the publishers where they got their money. So what we know is that publishers said that in 2012, they had a 7% drop in revenues from brick and mortar retail. And that includes Barnes & Noble, it includes grocery stores, it includes any kind of brick and mortar retail, Costco, Sam's, all the places that books are sold. And 2012 was the first full year that we saw in a post-borders world, of course, the Borders chain that went bankrupt and liquidated in the middle of 2011.
So this is Bookstats. This is the second year that this survey has been, they've been doing this survey?
It's actually the third year they've done it.
Okay. Well, at least it's not all bad news for publishing. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks.
I am here with David Carr, familiar to New York Times readers as our business and media columnist, and also author of the memoir Night of the Gun. And we are here to talk about his review of David Sedaris' new book, which he listened to on CD.
How appropriate. We're doing a podcast about an audiobook.
We're doing a podcast about an audiobook based on a book by a guy who basically started in audio. So the book is, or the audiobook is, Let's Explore Diabetes with Owls. Welcome, David.
Pleasure to be here.
So tell me about, you listen to this in the car.
Mostly.
Are you an audiobook in the car kind of person generally? Or
I'm going to have to admit to our readers, our listeners, that I am new to the genre. And I'm not new to David Sedaris telling stories in my car because he's often there on This American Life. But in terms of a book format, it was a new experience to me. And I learned some things along the way. Because as a reader, I'm a bit of a scanner. And I tend to zoom and look for the juicy parts. That's not what happens with audiobooks.
You can't really tune out or you get kind of lost.
No, they unfold on a schedule of the author's making, and you don't scan to the next part. You sit very still and quiet.
So how is David Sedaris on audio CD different from the Sedaris of This American Life on NPR?
I was stunned by the level, not the level, the amount of emotional content in what he does. I think of him as a fairly broad humorist and a person who's capable of, you know, he's kind of a random metaphor generator and a hilarious one at that. And the number of times where a story would end and I would have a sad or have a moment or think about how it arced into my life, I just, and perhaps it was because he was reading to me, but I found it very affecting.
And his stories kind of divide into, as you talk about, two distinct genres. There's the kind of fabulous contemporary David Sedaris who, you know, gets to travel endlessly on book tour after book tour and lives in France and England and has this amazing lifestyle now. He's a long way from, you know, being a Santa at Macy's as he was in his first collection. And then there's the stories of his childhood.
Right.
And was it those, the latter, that really resonated with you?
Yeah, there's, you sort of worry because Raleigh, North Carolina, where he grew up, now a distant land, now a distant shore. And so, but I found that, for one thing, his impersonation of his father, it will just take you apart. It's so hilarious. I don't know his dad, but I'm convinced he's got his dad absolutely dialed. So that's a very important voice.
Who's his dad? What's his dad like?
His dad is, everybody's impressed by David Sedaris, not his father. His father is distinctly unimpressed. And his father, in the book, there's an episode in which David's sister has been assaulted. And she was able to struggle away from this guy. But they went on one of these feckless family jihads looking for this guy who had just couldn't have been any more average in the place where they were. But the blame was assigned to his sister. The blame was assigned to David.
Now, is this Amy Sedaris or Lisa or which of his sisters?
It's probably Lisa, but don't hold me to that. And again, his father believes that you do things to the world doesn't do things to you. And his willingness to go on the attack, even as he pursues this person that attacked his daughter, is remarkable. I think that David Sedaris writes about relationships very well. He describes two in a train ride. One was an opportunity lost, where he probably should have hopped off the train with this mystical figure that he met. And the other was trying to conjure magic was some guy who probably had very little interest in him. And the aching, the longing, the wanting, the wishing, the sense of things gone away, opportunities missed, is somebody who's in a middle age and looking often in the rear view. I sometimes see those same shapes in my past as well.
Yeah, I mean, we think of him as a humorist, but what you're saying really is he's just as much a memoirist as a humorist, and that he...
I would agree. And the other thing is, to be frank, as a humorist, his set of politics, which is a common one in sort of New York-centric world, that anybody who doesn't think Obama is amazing is a moron. And of course, we all think middle America is fat or full of people who don't think very much. I'm from the Midwest. I find those kind of memes appalling and somewhat tiresome. And his point of view is an interesting one. It's just very well represented on Colbert, on Jon Stewart.
You could do the Woody Allen version in Annie Hall of like, so
excellent.
You think
true,
you're...
true, that it's been around for a while. And so his ability to sort of generate outrage from a certain point of view, and maybe it's because I'm a journalist, but I don't find it all that remarkable. Doesn't mean he's not good at it. He's plenty good at it. It just doesn't fall on me in a fresh and splendid way.
And so just to be clear, this book, it sounds from the title dangerously similar to his last collection, which was these animal stories, but this is not that, right?
No, there are animals that are anthropomorphized in this book, and there are humans that seem to take animal forms. But in general, most of the transactions take place between grown-ups. You get a sense between the lines of the relationship that he's living in, and I'm a sucker for stories about marriage or stories about long-running relationships because that's a territory in need of constant negotiation. You get a sense, as you always have in his work, of him negotiating the space between him and the world. He's an incredibly impatient, judgmental person, and rather than finding, as maybe David Foster Wallace would say, you know, you need to, these people are not in the way of your life, they are your life.
Right.
David Sedaris would beg to disagree.
Brush them aside in the line at the airport.
At least he'll just rain silent invective at them.
Right, mock them relentlessly in ways that we can't say on the New York Times Book Review podcast.
That would be correct. And he's not big on the use of profanities, but when he goes there, he's pretty good with the swears. I got to say, David can do it.
So for you, you read this in print and you listened to it. Was there an advantage to the audio version?
I can tell you that it left me with an appetite for more, that this would be a good way for a person like me who is an incredibly fast reader, but not always a careful reader, to experience work in its fullest dimensions, to just sit still and listen to the story unfurl. So it left me with an appetite for audiobooks, and I do have a couple of long drives planned this summer. So.
All right, David Carr, we will have to get you to review another audiobook for us in future. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a deep pleasure to be here.
Greg Coles is here with the bestseller lists. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Pamela.
So what is new this week on the list?
Well, I'm going to do something a little bit different this week. In the past on the podcast, listeners will know that I've always talked about what's new on the hardcover lists, fiction and nonfiction. That's what I write about in the column for a couple of reasons. Partly, I am a stodgy, old-fashioned guy, and I prefer the hardcover titles. It's also what's new. You know, these are the newest releases are what comes out in hardcover. And it's also because we get that data the earliest. And so I can start thinking about the column as soon as I have those numbers. And so in the future, I'll probably continue to focus mostly on the hardcover list in my column. But on the podcast, I'm going to shift starting this week to talking instead of what's new on the hardcover list, I'll talk about what's new on the combined print and ebook lists. And that's going to print there means paperback and hardcover, and then and the ebooks as well. Partly that's because the ebook list has migrated now out of the paper onto online only. And so this is a way to loop our readers in to what's new on the list.
Right. And right now, also, we're moving towards having what we call platform agnostic lists across the board in terms of the children's bestsellers now are integrated between the paper book and the print,
and
the hardcover format.
So are the advice and hardcover lists. And in making that shift, I mentioned last week on the podcast, you'll see that all the numbers have dropped down. They're in the single digits again because we just made that new list last month, and we had to reset all of those titles back down
to zero. Reset the clock. So what to expect when you're expecting is not a four-week-old newbie to the list.
No, it's actually been on for, you know, something like 608 weeks. But if you look at the list, it says, I think, 5 weeks now.
Well, let's talk about what is actually new.
Okay, so on the combined print and ebook list, what's interesting when you go to this combined list, because it's not just hardcover anymore, is it has the opportunity to pull in some older books. And new on the list this week at number 15 on the combined fiction list is a book from 1997. It's Ann Patchett's novel, The Magician's Assistant. It's a novel that she wrote before Bel Canto, which was her big breakthrough success and what made her really famous as a novelist. Certainly The Magician's Assistant had sold well before. I looked briefly to try to find out what made this new on the list this week. Why is it suddenly selling as opposed to any other Ann Patchett novel? And I couldn't find out. It's not like it's the new Oprah book. It's not, I don't think that it's a new ebook release this week. But something in the zeitgeist is out there, and suddenly people are buying Ann Patchett's The Magician's Assistant from 1997, new on the list.
You're going to have to Google that down and find out, solve the mystery for us listeners.
Then new at number 14 is truly a new book, Samantha Young's romance novel, Down London Road. At number 13, it's another older title, a book from 1985 is new on the list, Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. Even though that book came out in 1985, it has been a longtime bestseller on the kids' lists. It's kind of a cult classic of science fiction. It may be new on the list this week because there's a movie coming in November. The trailer was just released this last week, and so suddenly there's a lot of buzz about this book again.
It's interesting because there's always a debate, actually, of whether that's a bestseller, whether it's a children's book or a grown-up
book. Yeah, that's one of those early examples of a crossover novel where it's marketed, I think, to kids, but really a lot of grown-ups buy it. And that's true for some of the fantasy and science fiction genre, especially. It's got kind of broad crossover appeal. Then for the next new book on the combined fiction list, you have to jump up to number 9. Also, truly a new title. It's John Le Carré's A Delicate Truth. Really back to form for Le Carré, and this book's been getting a lot of attention.
It was our cover a couple of weeks ago.
That's exactly right. Reviewed by Olin Steinhauer.
Yes.
Yes. Then at number 8, Judith Merkle Riley is on the list with a historical novel called The Oracle Glass. At number 7, Richard Paul Evans is new on the combined fiction list with the fourth book of his Walk series. It's called A Step of Faith. Then at number 2, new to the list this week, is John Sanford's thriller Silken Prey. He is a regular on the bestseller lists, as is the title that's new at number 1 this week, new to the list, Charlene Harris's Dead Ever After. She writes the Sookie Stackhouse novels that are the basis for the HBO series True Blood. She's been writing them for a long time, and once True Blood came out, suddenly they became really hot sellers. In fact, the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago did a really interesting story about how frighteningly avid her fans are. They'll track her down at home. She actually needs a security detail when she goes to author conventions.
Blood dripping from their fangs.
Yeah.
And what do we have for nonfiction this week, Greg?
There are only 4 new titles on the nonfiction combined list this week. What's interesting is just like the Charlene Harris has a big boost from the TV audience, 3 of the 4 new nonfiction titles this week also have TV tie-ins.
See, people thought that TV was going to kill books, but look.
Actually, it's selling them instead.
It's a huge boon.
So new at number 11 on the combined nonfiction list is a book that's been hanging out on the hardcover nonfiction list for a while now. It's called The Duck Commander Family. It's by Willie and Corey Robertson, written with Mark Schlabach. Willie is the CEO and president of a duck call and duck decoy making business in Louisiana. The family behind that business is featured on a reality show on A&E called Duck Dynasty. When the 3rd season of that show started earlier this year, this book was released to coincide with that, and it became a bestseller then. Number 9 on the combined list is Mika Brzezinski, the Morning Joe co-host, has a book about food called Obsessed. And partly it's an advice book itself. It's kind of talking about how to have a healthy body image. She talks about how she's been obsessed with staying thin, and she sets herself the goal of actually putting on a few pounds, which is not what you see in most books about food. Then at number 8, the only book with no obvious TV tie-in is a book called Dad is Fat by the stand-up comic Jim Gaffigan. I say no obvious TV tie-in. He has done TV specials, and he's appeared on, you know, That 70s Show and some various other he's done some comedy acting. But this book is just one of these comedian's memoirs. It's about life with 5 kids in a small, a 2-bedroom New York City apartment. It's really like a fatherhood memoir. It's very funny. And then back to the Duck Dynasty, the Duck Commander family. New at number 1 on the combined nonfiction list this week is a book called Happy, Happy, Happy by Phil Robertson. That's Willie's father and the entrepreneur who started the Duck Commander.
I feel like I need like a family tree here.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen this show. They're pretty captivating. You know, they have a big audience in the Bible Belt. They're a Christian family. They're very popular among the Christian right because they are entrepreneurs, they're hunters, they're Christians. They make no bones about any of that on the show. Their politics are to the right. And so, you know, they have this big built-in audience rooting for them on all of those grounds. But they're also kind of kooky, and they're, you know, just very eccentric, humane. They during the hunting season, they grow these tremendously long, like ZZ Top beards. They don't shower. The men don't.
Glad for that distinction. Well, if you're going to read one book about ducks this week, or I guess you have the choice between 2 bestsellers.
It's got to be Happy, Happy, Happy.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you so much for joining us. There's more online at www.nytimes.com/books. And for the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.